psychiatric theories of the time. Lang proposed that schizophrenia shouldn't be seen as an illness, but as an adaptive behavior, a strategy for living in an unlivable situation. He suggested that madness might be a sane response to an insane world. Lang will be with us at 4 o'clock. At 3:40, 91FM arts reporter Christiane Vaillancourt will speak with film producers Ishmael Merchant and James Ivory, whose films include The Europeans, The Bostonians, and the new film A Room with a View. With me is Art and Aaron Neville of the New Orleans rock and roll band The Neville Brothers, and we just heard one of their records a second ago. Art Neville has been recording since his 1954 record Mardi Gras Mambo, which is still sold and played during Mardi Gras. Art did session work for years with Alan Toussaint and led the group The Meters, which had several hits, including The Sissy Strut. Aaron Neville of the Neville Brothers had the 1966 hit recording Tell It Like It Is. The Neville Brothers played together in the early 60s, but disbanded for economic reasons. They've been playing together as the Neville Brothers since the late 70s. Their latest album is Nevillization. They'll perform tonight at the Chestnut Cabaret in Philadelphia at 38th and Chestnut Streets. That's tonight at the Chestnut Cabaret. For information, you can call 382-1201. That's 382-1201. Welcome, both of you, to Fresh Air. I really enjoy your music.
Thank you
very much.
All right, let me ask you why the Neville Brothers got together again after you hadn't played as a unit for so many years.
Well, just the main reason was that we figured it was time for the family to get together. You know, everybody had been doing different things on their own, different separate projects, and we figured out we could still do this also, but, you know, do the family thing, have the family together.
When did you two start performing together? How old were you when you started singing together?
I guess I was in my teens. But, like, we used to, like, do just, I wouldn't say performing, but, like, out in the park, just singing doo-wop and stuff like that. We did that at an early age.
Now, I think, Art, you're a little older than Aaron, is that right?
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah, so it seems to me you grew up, actually, before rock and roll as such had actually started. So I wonder what music really influenced you when you were very young.
Well, when I started, I can remember listening to music. There weren't any, you know, like the radio stations you have now. You can turn down here just about anything you want to hear now. But at that point, it was more or less like whenever I was around where there was a jukebox. That's what they call them, jukebox, record player, whatever you want to call it. And, you know, that's where the records were. You know, they didn't have any radio stations. Then I remember hearing, they had, like, there was a station out in Nashville, Tennessee, that you could pick up all over. It was on a 100,000 watt clear channel station. You could pass. You didn't have anything else on the air, and you had people like, who was it?
Hoss Allen,
Gene Nobles. And I remember we had a radio. I can remember this distinctly, like one of the old time radio with an antenna, one wire antenna hanging out of the. And we used to pick that's when I first started hearing the real, what they call R&B at that point. That's what they was calling it then. Like, and they played everything from, you know, like the Spaniels, all of the doo-wop stuff, the Clovers, you know. And then that's the people that really influenced me, that made me want to. At that point, I didn't know whether or not I really wanted to do it, but I enjoyed listening to this music. And Hank Williams had a lot to do with it, because I heard a lot of country. A bluegrass, you know, that's what I was listening to.
What about things like the bands and the Mardi Gras and New Orleans jazz and the kind of music that's played at the funerals? Were you exposed to all of that when you were growing up, and did that influence you?
Yeah, well, you know, like, that's part of it's a way of life in New Orleans, really, you know. The second line beat, you know.
Which is what?
Well, it's hard to explain, you know.
Well,
what do you mean by the second line?
See, when you see a second line, the term second line really is not a form of music. A lot of people use that to describe what we do in New Orleans, because the music, well, the Dixieland music was kind of, it had the syncopated or rhythmic beat to it. And like the second line, this goes back to, what would you call this, jazz funerals, when they would bury somebody in New Orleans that was, you know, and involving music or something. They had a jazz funeral. He had a band. He had the family. Would march to the cemetery with a band playing, you know, like Closer Walk with Thee and, you know, spiritual type music on the way to the cemetery. And coming back from the cemetery, they would jam. They would come back.
Play old Didn't He Ramble.
Real serious. It was really serious, you know, hot Dixieland. And where the term second line came from, where you had the funeral procession with the family, and then you had another bunch of people, and whenever you see a parade, the people just started filing the parade. They didn't care whether it was a funeral or what it was. There was a band, that second line of people. That's where the term second line came from.
Now, as a pianist and organist, you'd be pretty well kept out of that kind of processional band, wouldn't you? A lot of the songs that you do as the Neville Brothers, and songs that you did as the Meters, have these chants in them. Where were you introduced to that kind of, is chant a good word for it?
Yeah, I guess from the Mardi Gras Indians, you know, like they had the Hip Pocket Way, Chacamo Finane. And I don't know what none of that means, but it comes from the Mardi Gras Indians.
So the Mardi Gras Indians are bands composed of Indians who
played? It's not bands. No, this is just a bunch of guys that different neighborhoods. Like a long time ago, they used to come out on Mardi Gras and they'd meet up and fight, have wars, you know, with guns and knives. But now it's the thing where they do it for the beauty of the costumes and who has the prettiest costume. You know, it's no more fighting. But it was just like neighborhoods. It wasn't a band. We probably were the first ones to really start the band thing with my Uncle Jolly with the Wild Chapatulas.
You tell us about your uncle who led, I think, the Wild Chapatulas that you both played in.
Right. Well, I can remember hearing stories about my uncle when I was a kid. My mother and my grandma used to talk about him a lot. That's my favorite uncle, incidentally, I mean, really. And he played piano. I never heard him play piano until I was grown. We finally lived together a couple of years before he died. But he got involved with the Indian thing for Mardi Gras, you know, doing the masking. And actually where that Mardi Gras Indian thing came from, one of the stories I got was that forgot how long ago it was, but in the early part of the Mardi Gras, when it first started in New Orleans, you know, the black people couldn't participate in the Mardi Gras. I mean, just as normal, just masking and whatever they wanted to do, so they would mask as Indians. And this is how this thing really got started, from what I understand, you know. That was the way to participate, and they would do it in neighborhoods, so different sections of town. So you had different gangs or different tribes, whatever you wanted to call it, you know. And
so that's why your uncle ended up with the name of Big Chief Jolly, because he played with an Indian band.
He actually didn't play an instrument. All they had percussion, tambourines, and you know, anything that could make a percussive sound, you know. And they would just chant these things like the Head Pocket Way. It was telling stories, really, you know, Mighty Cootie Fire, and all of these are some of the things that we use in these songs that we did as the Chapatulas. From what I could find out about this dialect, really was actually a language. I mean, it was French, but the pronunciation changed from generation to generation, and the Creole pronunciation, which, you know, like New Orleans is noted for the Creole, you got the you get into another trying to describe what that is. But anyway, the pronunciation just happened to change from generation to generation. Like when I heard it, when we first heard it, it was the Pocket Way, it was two-way Pocket Way. It probably meant something before that, but we pronounced it two-way Pocket Way. I'm sure it was something else. Just like I found out not too long ago that it's Mighty Coup de Fire is a French word for a gunfire, but it's not pronounced. The pronunciation is close to the way we pronounce it, but I can't speak any French, but somebody that could speak French was explaining this to me, and it changed the pronunciation of the, you know, these particular phrases changed from the Creole, from the French to the Creole, and as it passed down to us, like from generation to generation, everybody talks a little different now, you know.
Well, I want to play another Neville Brothers recording of Brother John Iko Iko, which has one of these kinds of chants that we're talking about. There,
yeah. Well, Brother John is talking about a real Mardi Gras Indian that got killed, and you know, in an incident, and they're saying Brother John is gone. He used to sing with the he was Smitten the Clowns and the Tick Tocks. His name was John.
John Williams, I think.
John Williams, yeah.
It's a story about someone that we knew.
Huh.
See, like all that whole album is telling stories about all of it is you know, everything on there is, you know, some sort of a story.
And where does the chant come from?
Well, the Brother John, my brother Cyril and my Uncle Jolly just came up with that. They made that up. But some of the other little phrases that we're using there are things that they drew on from the Mardi Gras Indians, the chants they would sing on Mardi Gras Day.
My guests are Art and Aaron Neville, and this is the Neville Brothers recording of Brother John Iko Iko. And I also want to mention that the Neville Brothers are performing tonight at the Chestnut Cabaret at 38th and Chestnut Streets.
Well, if you don't like what the big chief say, you just chalking more fina, hey. One more time, boy, chalking more fina, hey.
Read my lips,
chalking more fina, hey. Well, if you don't like what the big chief say, you just chalking more fina, hey.
Brother, brother, brother John is gone. Well, brother.
Everybody married.
That was Brother John Iko Iko, performed by the Neville brothers, and two of the Neville brothers are my guests, Art and Aaron Neville. Art is a keyboardist and singer, and Aaron is a singer and also plays percussion on the Neville brothers' records, and the Neville brothers are in Philadelphia to play tonight at the Chestnut Street Cabaret at 38th and Chestnut Streets. As we were listening to that, we were talking about the incredible mix of languages and musical cultures that go into a song like that. Aaron, you were telling me that the bass drum is really like a second line type of rhythm.
Like I was saying, a second line, it's like a freedom thing. You know, everybody, whatever the music tell you to do, your body just do it, you know.
And Art, you were telling me that I think your parents spoke mostly French when you were growing up?
Or? Yeah, well, I can remember my mother speaking, they call it patois. It was a broken
French.
French, a mixture of what they call Creole. And, you know, I remember whenever my grandmother, my mother didn't want us to understand what they were saying, they would start speaking this other language. Unfortunately, I never had a chance to find out what it meant, but some of these little chants that we are singing right now in these songs are, you know, probably came from this particular dialect or whatever you want to call it.
New Orleans really became a great place for rock and roll, both for people like Fats Domino who came out of the city, and a lot of performers would travel down to New Orleans because of the great session musicians there, including you, Art Neville, because you did a lot of session work in the 60s. Can you rattle off a list of some of the performers that you did session with?
I was like a studio brat. I used to hang around the studios on purpose because that's before I was really doing anything professional at this point. There's one record that I was on early, Little Richard, The Girl Can't Help It.
Oh,
the voice in the background, she can't help it. That's me doing that.
<Really? laughs>
And, you know, well, we did a lot of things with Dr. John, Lee Darcy, and a lot of the people I really don't remember. Like
Larry Williams,
I played, that's the fact, the first time I ever left New Orleans had the band called the Hawkettes. We left and backed Larry Williams when he had this record, Short Fat Fanny, Bonnie Maroney, the Hoochie Coo, and all this stuff like that. He was very big. Him and Little Richard were battling each other at that point. But like you mentioned, like Fats Domino, I used to go to a lot of the sessions, and I was able to be in the studio while he was recording a few things. And I listened to his music. I used to try to sing exactly like Fats Domino at one point.
Was he really popular in New Orleans? Because certainly, I grew up in New York, and he was just great, but I wonder sometimes in your own hometown, you're not as popular as you are far away.
I know, he was, for a long time before anybody heard about him outside of New Orleans, he was very big around there. He had some real serious music, some of the older stuff, if you could find some of this real obscure things on Fats. I think the biggest hit he had with Blueberry Hill was the thing that I think broke nationally, but he had a lot of stuff
going on. Gone Home Tomorrow and...
I mean, serious music.
Blue Monday.
Way before that,
right. So he really opened up ideas for you also, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
When you were doing session work, would you spend a lot of time rehearsing before you actually cut the session, or was a lot of it improvised?
A lot of it was improvised. When the group that we call the Meters now, you know, when we did it, we didn't rehearse none of that stuff. We just went in there, and it was just... we had an idea of format to go by. We knew what the song was about, what we wanted to do, and you know, a basic idea, and we just went for it. We did a thing with Robert Palmer at Sneakin' Sally Through the Alley, which I really enjoy listening to today myself, and that was just straight ahead, let's do it. This is how the song goes, and we played it. Dr. John, Right Place, Wrong Time, that album, and Desert Tivoli, Bonnaroo. And then we did one with Patti LaBelle, which was that a Lady Marmalade, mm-hmm. whatever, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a couple other people. I don't remember all of them, but we had fun doing those sessions. It was, you know, it wasn't any strict. Nobody was reading anything, you know, reading music.
Well, here's what I'd like to do. I'd like to play one of the Meters recordings. And then I want to play the Neville Brothers recording of Tell It Like It Is, which you had a hit of in the 60s. But so let's start with the Meters, and we're going to hear a very soulful a session. And this is called Look a Pie Pie, and you're playing organ on it. And right. Just to talk a little bit about the kind of organ that you're playing. What kind of organ
is it? It's a Hammond B3.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, at that point, you know, we didn't have synthesizers or anything like that. You know, we just used a guitar, no overdubs, just a regular guitar, the drums, the bass, and the organ. And in fact, we wrote this song riding in a station wagon somewhere in South Carolina somewhere. We were riding them down the highway. We started nothing to do. You got, four guys in a station wagon, a long way from home, and we just started riding along the highway singing, doing stuff like that. And we came home, we said, look, let's do something. We went in the studio and we started doing this, and we put the music to it.
Did you produce this record too?
We did it. The Meters did it, yeah.
Okay. Well, let's listen to it. This is Look a Pie Pie. What year is this recorded? What decade?
I don't remember.
Okay, let's hear it. Well, that's the Meters, a band that was led by my guest Art Neville, and also with us is Aaron Neville, and they're playing with more members of the family in a group called the Neville Brothers, who are in Philadelphia to perform this evening at the Chestnut Cabaret. That really sounded terrific, and it really made me think about how different organs are than synthesizers, and how I really wish there were more organs in rock and roll again.
Yeah.
Do you feel that way too?
Yeah. I just figure like whenever we get a chance to go back in the studio, I intend to use organ. On the stuff, organ and piano. You can use synthesizers, but don't make that beat. I mean, like most of the music, technical stuff, what they call it, the techno pop, whatever it is, you know, I like a lot of that, you know, a lot of that, you know, what these guys can do with these synthesizers, but I want to stay as basic as possible. And the B3 is one sound that will never be duplicated anyway.
When you're playing on sessions, no matter how big the hit becomes, only like a handful of rock critics and real devoted music listeners really know who the session people are and pay, you know, a lot of attention to it. Do you feel overlooked when a record that you're prominently featured on has become a big hit, but your name isn't prominently featured in it because you're
not
a session
really,
player?
No, I enjoy doing what I'm doing. It's, you know, it's not about that far as I'm concerned. I mean, it would be nice, you know, but it don't really matter, you know, because I'm glad to be able to hear something that I've done, you know, and I know people that are enjoying it, so that's good enough right there.
Aaron Neville, and I guess November, you were saying it's going to be the 20th anniversary of your hit "Tell It Like It Is."
Yeah.
How did you end up going off as a solo to record that record?
Well, at the time, I was like just gigging around New Orleans and doing different work, like riverfront and or driving a truck. And these fellas, George Davis and Lee Diamond, wrote the song with me in mind for me to record, and they had this label called Paulo Records, and we just went in and did it, and it came out, and I was kind of favoring another song, you know, kind of up-tempo thing, you know, and Art said, no, that's the one right there, and about a couple of weeks, they hadn't sold about 40,000 copies in New Orleans. It was heading up the charts, yeah, oh, it was scary.
What was scary about it?
I mean, just all of a sudden, you got a number one record, and, you know, and, hey, it was scary.
Do you remember the first times you heard it on the radio?
Oh, yeah.
What were you doing?
Well, I don't remember exactly what I was doing, but I remember the thrill I got from hearing myself on it, you know.
You have an incredible style of singing, as we'll be witness to in a moment. I'm sure a lot of it is unconscious, and it would probably be a mistake for me to ask you to describe what it is that you do, but are you conscious at all of what you're doing when you're singing? I mean, how...
Yeah, it's a thing like all of the wrong stuff that got going on in the world, you know, if I can just sing something sweet enough, come out to make it absorb that for a while for some people that's, you know, that's hearing my voice, you know, because it does it for me, you know, make up for some of the, am I saying it right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Have there been singers who've had a big influence on you?
Oh, yeah. I think way back, Nat King Cole, Hank Williams, Roy Rogers, and Gene Autry.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
From television and movies?
Yeah. And Pookie Hudson, the Spaniels, Clyde McFadden, quite a few flamingos.
I can hear the flamingos and the Spaniels and Clyde McFadden a little more than I can guess where Roy Rogers and Gene Autry.
Yodely.
You yodeled a lot?
Yeah, I like it. It's a therapy, you know. I use it. Serious.
Did you want to be a cowboy in there?
Well, I was a cowboy. I had the fastest mop stick in the Calio Project when I was coming, you know. That was my horse, Kimo Sabe.
Really?
Yeah. When I'd go to the movies and I'd come out, I was actually one of those cats, you know. I was either Lash LaRue or Tim Holder.
That's great, because, you know, coming from New Orleans, I'm thinking, you know, Mardi Gras and stuff, but part of you is in the movie theater, like,
oh, yeah,
like everybody in America
is,
wanting to be a gangster or a cowboy. Well, why don't we hear Tell It Like It Is, but we're not going to hear the recording from 20 years ago. We're going to hear one from a few years ago.
Yeah, which was also just played on Miami Vice.
Was it?
It was on the opening 2-hour special of this season.
Oh, the one that was rebroadcast on Sunday.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, so this is Tell It Like It Is, and the voice on this is my guest, Aaron Neville, and this is a recording by the Neville Brothers from their most recent album, Nevillization.
If you want something to play with, go and find yourself a toy. 'Cause baby, my time
is too expensive. And I'm not a little boy. No, no. You are serious. Don't play with my heart. It makes me furious. Oh, but if you want me to love you, then baby, I'm a wing. Girl, you know what I'm wing. Oh,
tell it like it is.
Don't be the singing. Let your conscience be your guide. I wanna know that deep down inside of me, I believe you love me. Forget your foolish pride. Oh. You know life is too short to have sorrow. Yeah. You may be here today and call tomorrow. So you might as well get what you want. So go on and live, baby. Go on and live. Oh. I'm nothing to play with it. Girl, you better find yourself tall. I know that deep down inside of me, I believe you love me. But I'm not your little boy. Oh, believe me, oh, believe me. Oh, 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 oh.
Tell it like it is.
What I love you, my dog. There is nothing I can do about it. Hey. I want to
tell it like it is.
That's the Neville Brothers and my guest Aaron Neville singing lead on that, singing backup vocals Art Neville, and the Neville Brothers are performing this evening at the Chestnut Cabaret. That is such a really great recording. Your singing on it is really wonderful. What happened to you after the hit of that was released? It topped the charts and everything. Then what happened?
Oh, well, I got to do a little touring for about till about 68 anyway, you know. I went out with Otis Redden, me and my Art and part of the Meters went to Canada and done a lot of touring, like Carolinas and Florida, and then the rest I put in the book.
you want to write a book about it?
Yeah, it'd have to be in volumes. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, it's a long story, you know.
One that you don't want to tell, or?
Oh, I'm going to tell it in a book, you know. Right. It'd take too long right now, though, you know.
Okay. But you didn't continue, though, as a, you know, on a solo career. Is there a moderate-sized answer or explanation about why?
Well, at the time, I was, you know, tied up with recording contracts and things, you know, and I was gigging where I could and, like I said, doing other kind of jobs on the side, You know, I might run to California, to New York, go and seek my fortune. But I couldn't get anything going because of, like I said, contracts. You know, I was being held captive. You know?
By this company that you recorded for?
Yeah.
So you couldn't break it or anything?
No, yeah. I just had to outlive it.
You're both together now, performing as the Neville Brothers with even more of your family, and you're based in New Orleans, but spend a lot of time touring. And I wonder what's left of the music scene in New Orleans now. I always figure that there must be two music scenes, one for tourists who don't know a lot about music and the other for insiders and tourists who do know
<You're>
a
right.
lot. Is that about the way it is?
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff going on there, if you know where to. In fact, well, we live on the same street, all of us, myself, Aaron, Charles, and Cyril. Same street we grew up on.
You're kidding,
one
really?
Block apart. In fact, there's a little, I call it a little, a ballroom right on the corner from our house where Cyril's been doing some things in there with some of the other guys in the band. He does a lot of reggae-type influence music. And the people, it's surprising that people are from Europe, from Japan, found this little place, and they'd be in there. I mean, it's a little small. It's a very, very small place. There's a lot of good music in New Orleans, but you just, you know, you have to.
You won't find it all in the French Quarters, you know. You just have to go.
Now, if people think that the French Quarter is New Orleans, that's, well, you know, that's what the commerce people, that's what they advertise about, you know, the French Quarter, but that's not the whole deal.
So what kind of music would you hear there if you went there?
Oh, you could hear any, what you mean, in the French Quarter?
Yeah.
Almost.
Yeah, good. There's good music there, yeah. But I mean, that's not everything about it. It's not all. That's not New Orleans. That's not representative of New Orleans. But people think when you see New Orleans, they think about Dixieland jazz. Well, Dixieland jazz is a form of music that's it's still being played. You know, but a lot of the older guys who really created this music, most of them are dead now, and you got younger people doing it. Some of the original people are still alive, but that's not the only thing as for you know that I would consider. Representative of New Orleans. It's a lot.
Tell you
of,
what, just come to the Jazz Festival down there and
right,
you can check everything out, you know, from.
I've heard so much about that
rock
festival.
And roll to soul,
someday
to gospel.
I'm going to try to get down there.
Yeah.
What's it like for you now to be playing together as a family and, you know, establishing yourselves with audiences as the Neville Brothers now? Do you. Because a lot of the record buying audience. Is pretty young, and they wouldn't necessarily remember your earlier hits. So in a way, you're kind of, even though you've been around for a long time, you're introducing yourselves in a lot of ways
right.
to the newcomers to music. So what's that experience been like for you?
I think it's been good because like the music is don't have an edge to it, you know, and it's being proven by our crowds, like you know. What age do you think that is from?
I think we cover the whole thing. Like the people that, you know, you got the young crowd, you know, and all the way up to people our age, you know, are older, can enjoy what we do. And it's been, like, we did this tour with Huey Lewis. That was like, to me, an ultimate test because the first beginning of that tour was a lot of young, what I call upper middle class white kids. And if they dig what you're doing, because they will let you know immediately we don't like it, you know.
How would they let you know?
I'm sure they'd let you know if they didn't like it, you know. But, it was great. It was received extremely well. They didn't know what we were saying, as far as these chants and things that we're doing. But the music was strong enough, and the harmonies were strong enough to capture their attention, and they got into it. And so I feel like, you know, when you got to, an audience like that, when you can get the young people, I figure we got some longevity. We'll be here for a while. I just figure when this thing does stick, it's going to stick serious. And all these years that we've been paving the way for it, it's going to be worth it.
Now, one more thing before we have to wrap up. The music traditions that you were brought up on and the introduction to the chants and the music of the Mardi Gras and the funerals and everything, is that still around? Are those traditions still there, or have they been changed through commercialization and tourism and stuff?
No, they still have them. The jazz funerals, yeah. That's probably always be a part of New Orleans, you know.
And the chants.
Just to show you that, yeah. New Orleans will party
Instead of a parade or the drop of a hat or a party.
So they'll even party at a funeral, so you know.
There's something happening at all times. Like I said, the music, if you want to find, if you want to hear some, there's a lot of artists that probably would never be heard anywhere but in New Orleans. For a long time, we didn't come out of New Orleans. I mean, a lot of people did. They would hear stories about the Neville Brothers, but nobody could never see the Neville Brothers until, you know, we got a chance. We did some tours with the Rolling Stones and, you know, the Huey Lewis thing. We did a couple of weeks ago with the Grateful Dead. And now people hear us and they enjoy what we do. So there's fortunately, we are some of the ones that are blessed enough to be able to come out of there. But there's a lot of great music. I mean, great people out there in New Orleans that probably will just live and die right there, and nobody will never know it until after they're
like
dead.
Like Professor Longhair, Professor, James right. Booker.
Yeah, just for a few, to name
yeah,
a few.
Yeah. Well, listen, it's been great to meet you. I enjoy your records very much, and I'm so glad you're able to come and visit with us. Thanks a lot for
pleasure.
Being here.
Thank you. It's our pleasure.